It's not easy to be a Unitarian Universalist military chaplain. I think of Bill Gohegan. Reverend Gohegan was minister of the New Bedford congregation back. He was installed in 1902. And when World War One started for America in 1917, he asked the congregation for a leave of absence so that he could go to France and join the troops and serve as a military chaplain, which they granted. So Reverend Gohegan had never really been out of New England. He got to France, and very soon after he arrived, the war ended, and American troops started coming home. But Reverend Gohegan loved Paris. There was the Notre Dame Cathedral, the Sacré-Cœur, the Eiffel Tower, and of course, just down the street from the Sacré-Cœur, the Moulin Rouge, and great restaurants and places to sit outside and have coffee. Finally, the president of the congregation, Mr. Prescott, a wealthy member, attorney in the church in New Bedford, wrote Reverend Gohegan and said, "You're having too much fun. Unitarians come out of a Puritan tradition. If you don't come back by this date, you no longer will have a position as our minister." And Reverend Gohegan stayed in Paris, overstaying his the date when he was supposed to return, and so the congregation fired him. As I said, it's not always easy to be a Unitarian military chaplain. The first record we have was actually of a Universalist military chaplain, the Reverend John Murray. Murray, those of you who are experts in our history would know, John Murray came from London and founded the Universalist Church in America in Gloucester, Massachusetts. In 1775, he was asked by the Rhode Island Militia to be their chaplain, to be their military chaplain. 1775. This was even before the Declaration of Independence, but war had started already with Lexington and Concord, and the British were occupying Boston. George Washington was sent by the Continental Congress to the Boston area to take command of the colonial troops, and he met the chaplains there, including Reverend Murray, John Murray, the Universalist chaplain. So Murray was given the opportunity to give a series of sermons in the area around Boston, places like Jamaica Plain, where the militias were centered trying to figure out a way to move the British out of Boston. And he gave Universalist sermons in which he said, "You don't need to be afraid of death, because when we die, there is no hell, and all of us will go to heaven." The other chaplains heard this and wanted Reverend Murray removed from the chaplaincy. They went to General Washington and said, "You know, this man is preaching heresy. How dare we have him as part of our chaplain corps?" And to George Washington's credit, he said, "No, we keep the Universalists. They can be part of our military chaplaincy." So it's a long tradition in our Universalist and our Unitarian heritage. There are about 30 chaplains in our movement during the Civil War. I don't know the number during World War II, but there were a significant number of younger Unitarian and Universalist clergy who served as chaplains during World War II. I know Robert Weston was a chaplain in the United States Naval Reserves, and he used his experience where he had to conduct so many funerals and memorial services as a chaplain to write a 1945 book called Cup of Strength, Readings in a Time of Sorrow and Bereavement, a book that some of us in the ministry still use when we officiate at memorial services. This all changed in the 1960s. Most Unitarian Universalist ministers came to oppose the war in Vietnam and were not interested in becoming military chaplains. In my own case, when I turned 18 in 1969, I applied to my draft board for status as a conscientious objector. And filling out the application, I signed this statement. I am, by reason of my religious training and belief, conscientiously opposed to participation in war in any form. And I am further conscientiously opposed to participation in non-combatant training and service in the armed forces. Under the section called Describe the Nature of Your Belief, I wrote, I believe, because of my religious training, that all men have an element of humanity, and through love, this humanity can be awakened in all people. To kill, even because of national or self-interest, would contradict universal religious teachings, which I believe, that man should grow and produce the maximum harmony with God and his fellow man. Because of this, I am conscientiously opposed to participation in war in any form. Now, in 1969, most draft boards only granted conscientious objector status to men who could prove they were active members of one of the historic peace churches. You had to prove you were a member of the Church of the Brethren, the Society of Friends, the Quakers, or the Mennonites, or a subgroup of the Mennonites, the Amish. Because I was a Unitarian Universalist, they turned me down. I appealed and was granted a hearing. At the hearing, I gave evidence that my mother, who had died several years before, when I was 14, that my mother had been raised a Mennonite. And on these grounds, I became the first Unitarian Universalist in Arizona to be recognized as a conscientious objector. Now, this has been a key part of my identity, starting when I was 18 years old. The Unitarian Universalist ministry has made it possible for me to live my life in such a way that I've been able to religiously oppose war and the military. I have given sermons for many years suggesting ways we can respond to wars in constructive, nonviolent ways. I have always included a sentence in such sermons saying that many Unitarian Universalists are not pacifists. Nevertheless, it has been easy to be a pacifist Unitarian Universalist minister. In the five churches that I have served, only a few people have walked out on my sermons on nonviolent alternatives to war. Although people often disagree with me, they often challenge my ideas. They do so with respect. And I always learn from such exchanges of ideas. Because of the tragedy of the Vietnam War, my generation of Unitarian Universalist ministers shares my opposition to war and my desire to find alternatives. Our current Unitarian Universalist president, Peter Morales, moved to Canada during the Vietnam War and returned to the United States only after the war ended. This is why the sermon at the Service of the Living Tradition last summer was a break with tradition, recent tradition. One colleague wrote, as a lifelong pacifist and Unitarian Universalist, I was appalled as I sat in the Service of the Living Tradition as an honoree at the end of my full-time service to our ministry. 42 years of such service should have been celebrated that night, but instead I felt much of it questioned or belittled. Those many years have included draft resistance counseling, war protests, and more. But there I was, being offered a sermon by someone in uniform, with much of the liturgy offered by others in uniform, the uniforms of conformity to a system of authority and conduct with which I have great disagreement. The anti-war generation of ministers, shaped by the experience of the Vietnam War, that generation that I am a part of, is now in the process of retiring. A new generation of ministers has been shaped by the attacks of September 2001. As a result, the number of Unitarian Universalist military chaplains has grown. Today, we have gone from zero in 2001 to 15. They are not always welcome in our congregations. The Reverend David Pyle is a United States Army Reserve chaplain. David writes, "A few years ago at a Unitarian Universalist Houston network event, a woman challenged in a loud and public way, how could I dare call myself a Unitarian Universalist and be willing to serve in the military? The heresy that I committed that day was mentioning in public that I was considering service as a military chaplain after seminary. It is certainly not the only time I have been called out for such heresy." David Powell writes, "I understand that there are many in our movement who deeply wish Unitarian Universalism were a pacifist faith, but that is certainly not in line with our history. Nor do I feel it is in line with our deepest held values and beliefs." Reverend Powell goes on, "I am not a pacifist because I do not believe pacifism has any practical reality in the world as it currently exists." Well, I agree with Reverend Powell about his first point. We are not a pacifist church. Unitarians and Universalists have a tradition of members serving in the military, going back to the American Revolution. The two most recent members of the president's cabinet who were Unitarian Universalists were both Secretaries of Defense, William Perry and William Cohen. However, unlike Reverend Pyle, I believe that pacifism is a practical approach in the world as it currently exists. As I said to my draft board when I was 18, I believe that human life is the most sacred entity on earth. I believe that each of us has a spark of divinity in our soul, which, if properly nurtured, can help us develop into sensitive, compassionate persons. Through kindness and understanding, people can learn to live together in peace. Therefore, I believe no one has the right to take the life of another human being. Other Unitarian Universalists are not required to share my belief. They are free to agree or disagree. Nevertheless, this belief is central to who I am. I do not think my approach is naive. I am not blind to the existence of evil in the world. War is evil. Killing is evil. Abuse is evil. Poverty is evil. But so is an unwillingness to see the spark of divinity in each human being. Once we refuse to see this spark of divinity in every person, we consign people to being beyond the pale, totally and irretrievably evil. Once this is done, we no longer have any desire to influence another person except by force. As long as we hold to our belief in the potential goodness in a person, no matter how corrupt the person might be, we at least have the possibility of finding a way to live at peace with that individual. So each day I read news stories about how ISIS leaders have killed hundreds of men, women, and children, and I know that this is evil. However, I also know that the ISIS leaders, acting on non-pacifist values, have been attempting to do their best for their people. The spark of divinity is there, though by pacifist standards, it is grossly misdirected. The pacifist knows we must somehow keep open the lines of communications if we can influence ISIS in any way other than by force. So I try hard, sometimes to the point, it seems, of leaning over backward to see the positive accomplishments of those that are to be our enemies. For example, this spring, the World Health Organization and UNICEF worked with local public health agencies launching a massive polio vaccination campaign in Iraq, Syria, and Egypt. They hope to reach 20 million children younger than 5 over 5 days. Vaccinations were shipped. This summer, just when the authorities thought they had turned the tide, Islamic State fighters launched a deadly offensive and overran Mosul and the surrounding towns, throwing the campaign against polio into turmoil. All of a sudden, complete districts fell to the Islamic State fighters. The healthcare workers didn't know the fate of the vaccine in these captured areas. Soon officials received news that the Islamic State, a movement claiming to represent Sunni Muslims, hadn't halted the polio vaccinations or halted the general health services being provided by the Shia-dominated Iraqi government. Overall, the campaign reached 3.75 million of the 4 million children under 5 living in Iraq. No new polio cases have been confirmed in the country since April. So the Islamic State fighters, who are killing men, women, and children, have also allowed polio vaccinations to go forward. Apparently, they share with us a desire that children not get polio. Pacifists look for such common ground. We look for ways to invent options of mutual gain. We look for ways to invent solutions that are advantageous to both sides. Much of what we hear in the media demonizes the other side. However, what we are told is not always true. I remember in November 1990, before the first Gulf War, I met with Illinois Congressman John Porter. I was living in Evanston at the time, and John Porter was my representative in Congress. I argued that if we went forward with an invasion of Iraq, the invasion had not yet occurred, the angry rage of many Arabs towards the United States was likely to greatly increase as our Christian troops made war on Islamic peoples. I suggested to the congressman that we wait for sanctions to work, that was a nonviolent alternative to an invasion. Well, then he replied to me by describing how Iraqi soldiers took babies out of incubators in a Kuwait hospital, took the incubators, and left the babies to die. He described it as brutality and inhumanity and sadism. Well, months later, it turned out that Congressman Porter's eyewitness to this was, in fact, the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, and that she had been not in Kuwait, but in San Francisco when she claimed she was in Kuwait seeing this event. Furthermore, it was revealed that Congressman John Porter was renting office space in Washington at a very reduced rate from the public relations firm that had provided this woman as a witness, and that the PR firm had written her testimony, that they had coached her so that she would cry at just the right moment in the testimony. This was all to give a justification for our nation to go to war. Now, 24 years later, the congressman is long retired, but we are still involved in a war in Iraq. In September 2001, I spoke on CNN. I said, although I am a pacifist, I believe in police. If, as the investigation proceeds, the evidence for the attack on our country continues to point to people who are now living in Afghanistan, we should provide that evidence to whatever government is in Afghanistan in the same way we provide evidence when we ask for extradition of criminals in other countries. If the Afghanistan government refuses to cooperate in arresting these individuals, then I would support an international police force made up of people from all countries who are willing to participate, to use overwhelming force to try to arrest those responsible for these terrible crimes. But I do not support, I said, an invasion, an ongoing occupation of Afghanistan. Of course, in the rush to war, no one took my advice seriously. 13 years later, we still have troops in Afghanistan. So last summer, I watched on my computer, on the internet, the service of the living tradition, the worship service at the annual meeting of the Unitarian Universalist Association. I watched my friend and colleague, the Reverend Rebecca Montgomery, an Army Reserve chaplain, give the sermon. When Rebecca described how Afghans had never seen a female soldier driving a Humvee, and how the Afghans' worldview was completely shattered when the interpreter explained to the amassing crowd that she was actually an officer and a chaplain, I thought, oh, Rebecca, it all sounds so charming. But you're describing how American Christians, using modern weapons of war, are occupying a third world Islamic country. Eventually, we will leave Afghanistan. Eventually, we will leave Iraq, just as we left Vietnam. And we will look back, those of us, our children will look back. Perhaps we won't be alive, but others will be. And they will look back in a few years, and they'll wonder whether all that loss of life, all those terrible injuries suffered by good men and women, good young people from America, whether their deaths, their suffering, was worth the result. If we learn from these experiences, perhaps in the future, we will begin to consider alternatives to military action. So I am a pacifist Unitarian Universalist on this Sunday of Remembrance for World War I. I am allied with the Quakers, the Mennonites, the Brethren, the Amish, the pacifist Roman Catholics, the pacifist Buddhists, the Hindu followers of Gandhi, and the Islamic pacifists. Others will dismiss us as an impractical group, but I believe our reliance on military force is what is impractical. All social change begins with a small group of people and gradually, slowly grows. Perhaps a tipping point is near. For we live in an increasingly interconnected world, a world of interconnected commerce. More people are traveling today than ever before in the history of the world. a world where communication flows more freely and more comprehensively than ever before. As these connections grow between us, perhaps eventually wars and military chaplains will be history. So the Sunday before Veterans Day, this is my prayer, my hope for our children.